historically low is the rate of reactants. When you look at the Brown and Woodward curves for reactants, and you look at this, it's a whole family of curves of various diameters of the radiator of the ground plane antenna. As the radiator gets larger and larger diameter, very rapidly, the slope of the change in reactance versus frequency comes down real fast. If you want a broadband antenna, it's got to be large in diameter, or it's got to be broad in making it out of sheet metal. So reactance is where it's really happening. And so that RF tap of yours, boy, is that a reactive device. And so it does the job very nicely. You don't have to measure the capacitance. And you like to set it at 50 dB of isolation and lock it down. There's nothing magic about locking it down, Joe. As long as you have the ability to measure the amount of coupling, when you go down to 6 meters or up to 1296 and you want to readjust it to get your favorite number, 50 dB, and you have to move that rod, I wouldn't be afraid to move that rod, because getting it set back again, as long as you get the right instrumentation, that's relatively easy. So B2RYY, are you a little bit amazed at 98,000 to 1 standing wave ratio to B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet? I was.
The bird specs, I'm on the screen if you want to hear.
Okay, give us a couple of words. What does bird say about this thing? Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
And I am assuming that he has a model 4275, which covers a frequency band of 20 to 1,000 megahertz with an attenuation range of 35 to 80 dB down from the main power. Couplers have a locking device under attenuation control, and go down to where the additional details are. It says that the maximum power is 1,000 watts. The insertion SWR is 1.1 max from 2 to 512, and 1.25 max from 512 to 1,000. The insertion loss is 0.1 dB maximum between 2 and 512, and 0.2 dB between 512 and 1,000. They give you coupling tolerances as a maximum coupling tolerance of plus 10 dB / minus 3 dB, which I'm not quite sure what they mean by that, and a minimum coupling of minus 10 dB / plus 3 dB. And then below that, there is a curve of the coupling values per frequency. That's what they've got on their spec sheet.
And where they declared the insertion loss of 0.1 dB or something like that, they use that number because the real number is probably 0.02. However, the average guy cannot measure that number, and therefore he would be making a complaint that it's out of spec. A 0.1 dB of insertion loss at a kilowatt going through the thing, I could calculate the number of watts of heat it would be generating. I'm going to do that in the next few minutes. And the thing wouldn't be, I know darn well the thing runs almost ice cold when you're putting a kilowatt through it with good connectors on the end. So the real insertion loss is very low. You can inject signals, a weak signal can easily be injected with that thing. The only slight difficulty you have with that RF injector is that when you insert it in the line going to a receiver, when you insert it in the line going to the transmitter, or you insert it in the line that goes to the antenna on a duplexer, in either case, you're changing the length of that line by roughly 2, 2.5, 3 inches. And that change of length of that line could, in some cases, make a slightly disturbed situation. You're trying to do an installed performance of this duplexing filter, and when you're adding an extra length to one of those three lines, in some cases, you're slightly contaminating the measurement you're trying to make. I would use the RF device to get it into the ballpark, but I would then take it back out of the system and inject the signal by another sneaky method, by having a sniffer antenna in the shack that sends a signal out into the air, and some of it gets picked up by the antenna that's on top of the tower, and that's a way of injecting a signal in order to continue with the tweaking operation. But except for that very minor perturbation it makes, this is a rather ideal tool. It can be any amount of isolation you want between 20 and 90 dB on most of those frequencies, and it has an insertion loss that's damn close to 0 dB. of HRIY. That's a good thing you bought. And buy more of them if you find them. KQRIW, go ahead, Joe.
You can buy one brand new. They're only about $90. They're, you know, brand new. But they're not. And I knew that originally, so I think I saw it like for $20, $25. The thing was in very good shape. The silver wasn't tarnished very well on it, so I picked it up. Good deal. Places I've worked for in the past, I have got the management to buy a couple of them. They end up working very well. Here's something I'm curious of, and I have wondered about this. Because I originally set the thing with a power meter. That's how I originally did it. Not even spectrum analyzer. I used a calibrated power meter, and I put, I think I put about plus 20 dBm into the thing. That's what the generator could handle, like full blast. And adjusted it for about a minus 30 on the tap, looking at with a power meter, because the power meter really wouldn't measure too much below, you know, minus 30. They have a little trouble reading, like, you know, 35 or 40. It's like using like a flaky type of a reading, but power he was using was actually from an Enritsu unit, and it could accurately read down to minus 30 without really any problem at all. That's how I initially set it, but when I put it into an analyzer, I got pretty much the same reading. Now, putting that into the input of a frequency counter, I don't know if that was 50 ohms, and here's the question. If I got a 50 dB drop looking into something that looked like a 50 ohm impedance at the output of that tap connector, and all of a sudden I put that into something that does not have a 50 ohm impedance and has a much higher impedance, would the RF voltage out of that tend to be a little higher, yielding a little more power into the device? Back to you.
Absolutely. If I have a pure 50 ohm ideal signal generator going into an ideal 50 ohm load, and right at the point where it's going into the load, I've got an ideal voltmeter. My ideal voltmeter is going into some kind of a tapping device. It's not disturbing the impedance. My ideal voltmeter has got an infinite impedance. It's not loading the line. So I'm measuring real voltage going into the dummy load at the end of this transmission line. I then remove the dummy load, the 50 ohm dummy load, and I've now got a pure open circuit at that end. What happens to the voltage? It doubles. No matter what your signal generator is, when it's properly loaded, when that signal generator has the right load on it, and you go from the right load to an open circuit, the voltage that you see will double. That's a 6 dB increase. So if your sampling device, which in this case is the RF tap, by a capacitive coupling, twice the amount of voltage, you're going to get 6 dB less apparent insertion loss. That's the laws of physics, a way a signal generator works. Every signal generator, of all the voltage it makes internally, half of it's lost into its own internal resistor. A 50 ohm signal generator, that you're getting 1 volt out of it. The real source of signal inside is 2 volts, which is going through a pure 50 ohm series resistor. Half the voltage is being dropped. The other half is appearing as the 1 volt on your load on the output. Every single generator, ideal signal generator, behaves that way. If you use the Thevenin equivalent circuit for the way your signal generator works. Does that make some sense, Joe? W-H-O-R-Y-Y, wait for the beeps, K-2-R-A-W.
So that even works if you take the load impedance and change it on the output of the tap, you're making the thing into, say, you're putting it, like I said, you're putting it into a high impedance of a frequency counter. It's not even 50 ohms, it might be very, very high, very, very high impedance, couple of K impedance. So you think it's going as much as 6 dB less out of the tap. So instead of the power being minus 50 dB, it's only like minus 44. Well, I thought about that, and in a lot of cases, the devices won't be blown up. If you're theoretically putting in, instead of 0 dBm, you're putting in plus 6, because you had 100 watts of power out of an amplifier or a transmitter that you're feeding through into a dummy load. 50 dB now would be 0 dBm. 44 down would be plus 6 out of the tap. That still will not damage the frequency counter. It shouldn't. It may overload it. It may overload a spectrum analyzer as far as the mixer is concerned, but you're probably not going to do something like smoke something and cause serious damage. That's why I like setting it to a high number like 50. It's a very safe level to play with.
Yes, it is. A 100-watt transmitter, when it comes to repeater service, very rarely are you going to be operating much beyond 100 watts. is plus 50 dBm. 50 dB stronger than 1 milliwatt is 100 watts. Therefore, if you've got your RF cap set for 50 dB of isolation, plus 50 dBm out of the 100 watt transmitter turns out to be 0 dBm, 1 milliwatt, and very few instruments are going to be damaged by 1 milliwatt. There is a kind of very sensitive power head for some of the Hewlett Packard power meters, which is not allowed to go above minus 20 dBm, but that's a rare item. So very few things are going to be damaged by 0 dBm. On top of that, a frequency counter, you think a frequency counter might be an open circuit. I don't think so. They're not a good 50 ohm load, but I don't think they're a pure open circuit, most frequency counters. But maybe they are. You know, the manufacturer will probably give you a spec on that. Let me drop. Now, this RF tapping device, just to be on the conservative side, Bird, in their data sheet that Eric just read to us, says it's got no more than a tenth of a dB of insertion loss. If it had a tenth of a dB insertion loss, and you were continuously putting a kilowatt through it, I know damn well it would run nearly ice cold. A tenth of a dB of loss, resistive loss, at a kilowatt, is a little bit shy of 23 watts of dissipation. If for any length of time, the thing would be glowing red hot, 23 watts in a small little package, and most of it would be on the semiconductor. It'd be glowing that semiconductor, if you know what I mean. That's good evidence that it's nowhere near a tenth of a dB. Now, when it comes to the insertion loss of something like this device, to simply do a substitution test, where you've got a set of connectors that you can put together between your power sensing device and your signal generator, and you open up those connectors and put in this RF tap, and you try to measure the difference in insertion loss, and you try to resolve with high accuracy a tenth of a dB. Let me drop. You'll be amazed how difficult that measurement is when you're looking for that kind of resolution. A tenth of a dB, you'd like to be able to resolve to the nearest 0.01 dB to measure a tenth of a dB with some accuracy. When it comes to apparent insertion loss for things like this, you've got to separate real loss from apparent loss. By apparent loss, if there's a little bit of standing wave ratio and some of the power is being reflected, you will measure what you think is an insertion loss. Real insertion loss is I squared R loss. But by way of standing wave ratio reflections, you think you're seeing loss. The power is just simply going somewhere else. So does that thing dissipate to 23 watts when you put a kilowatt through it? No way. So they're being super conservative. They've given you that number just to lower the number of times that people will say, hey, this thing's out of spec, and I'm mailing it back to you. Because depending on how you make that measurement, you could easily see what you think is two-tenths of a dB of loss because, let me drop this. You think your signal generator is a 50-ohm source. It might be a 45-ohm source. You think your power meter is a 50-ohm load. Your power meter detecting it is a 50-ohm load. It might be a 53-ohm load, if you know what I mean. Because of the differences of impedance of signal generator, signal loading device, detecting device, and the real standing wave ratio of the input connector and the output connector of this RF tap, depending on length of cables and how you made the measurement, boy, you could see all kinds of, you could see 0.01, 0.1, 0.2, probably even 0.25 dB of apparent insertion loss, which isn't real. If any of you want to know the I squared R loss of something like this, put a known amount of power through it, like a kilowatt, and measure how hot it gets. Calorimetry, measuring heat in a case like this, is a very accurate technique of measuring true insertion loss. Measuring insertion loss between a signal generator and a power meter can give you a lot of crazy readings in this environment. So meet your RYY for any further comments. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Well, I'll give you a closing comment. I agree exactly what you talked about, and I don't believe the thing has a tenth of a dB loss. I think it's far less than that. I'll tell you why. Years and years ago, when I ran at one location, I ran a quarter kilowatt transistor on UHF, I could run the amplifier out at least 250 out, maybe slightly less than that, to give me 200 watts out of the duplexer. And I did a test for a length of time. I wanted to do a T-down test. The amplifier is rated for continuous duty. I wanted to do check for spectral purity over a length of time. I had that going into a piece of quarter-inch superflex out of the duplexer into my 50-ohm load, which is rated for at least higher. I had that tap between the quarter inch superflex cable and dummy load, and I think really what I felt as far as a slight bit of warmth on the device itself was probably more conductive heat from the dummy load going back into this thing because it's physically touching it than coming from the device itself. So I truly believe that their tenth of a dB figure is probably twice or three times what it actually is in reality. That you could not feel really any degree of warmth to this thing at all, putting, you know, 200 watts, putting 200 watts into it for a length of time.
That's an extremely good confirmation. By the same token, back in the days when people were claiming that each UHF connector, because of such an impedance mismatch, 30 ohms in a 50 ohm system, a UHF connector has an internal impedance of approximately 30 ohms. And so because of that, what they thought is a 1.4 to 1 or something like that standing wave ratio, they thought they're getting half a dB of loss. Absolutely not. I have personally put 700 watts at 432 megacycles to a pair of UHF connectors, PL259, SO239, bullet, and back to another PL259. With 700 watts keyed down for 10 solid minutes at 432 megahertz, the thing got mildly warm to the touch. Mildly warm is probably about a watt of heat, something like a 0.02 dB of insertion loss. So lots and lots of guys, you guys have heard me say before, I've heard people from time to time say, I got my Mirage amplifier, it came with UHF connectors on it, I converted them all over to Type N, so the heavy dB of loss of getting on the two connectors, I've now got a dB of more gain out of this thing because I changed the connectors. Absolutely not. But there are lots of people who believe that. True insertion loss. To really make insertion loss at RF frequencies, you need length. Let me drop it. 100 feet of RG8 cable, or 100 feet of LMR 400, that's got length, and is therefore capable of creating some insertion loss. You know, the 2 dB per 100 foot, the 4 dB per 100 feet, the rating of the cable, length. Devices like this RF tap and UHF connectors, they don't have any length. Unless you made them out of carbon granules, as long as you, then they would have some loss. But if they're made out of a reasonable conductor, and they've got a short length of, you know, inch, inch and a half, and so on, you can't have any substantial amount of insertion loss. The physics is not there, but everybody believes it. And just because you've got a 30 ohm impedance inside the connector, when it's only an inch and a half long, so to speak, and an inch and a half long at 432 is 1/20th of a wavelength. Even though you've got an impedance mismatch, you've only done it for 1/20th of a wavelength. That gives you a very small amount of resultant standing wave ratio. Again, it takes length. You can have a substantial fraction of a wavelength of the missed impedance before you start seeing some really funny effects, if you know what I mean. So, we at times lose a lot of sleep over minor perturbations to our system. Let me drop this. There are people who lose a whole lot of sleep about the fact that they've got a 50 ohm cable that goes halfway out to the tower. They ran out of 50 ohm cable. They use 70 ohm cable for the next half. And now 50 to 70 interface between the two that calculates to something like a 1.4 standing wave ratio. And they think they're going to get a whole lot of loss out of that. Most cases, the answer is no. And you'd be amazed how many ways there are of correcting that very minor impedance mismatch. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio in a system creates an amount of reflected power that gives you less than half a dB of throughput power. You can't lose more than half a dB with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And most of us have systems that are well below 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on each of the interfaces. Anybody have any further questions or comments on all of the above? Give me a call, letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Just wondering something, Dick.
Go right ahead, Eric. Wait for the beeps.
When Joe did his setup, what did he actually have to move? I mean, you're talking about notch duplexing. Was it just as simple as moving the notch frequency to make it work better, or did he actually have to readjust the curves of both duplexes?
I heard a half of a word from somebody. No identification of any kind. We'll pick you up in a second. well aligned on a 50 ohm instrumentation system. When you plug it into the real world, where the real antenna is a little bit different than 50 ohms, the real receiver is quite a bit different than 50 ohms, the real transmitter is a little bit different than 50 ohms, match of isolation will move. Does the real filter bandpass move so that you get an entirely new bandpass? Not at all. The notch is very sensitive. It moves a little bit. So if you're skilled in the way you can do some very minor tweaking, installed performance, I'm convinced you can get the notch to come back to your desired frequency with almost no change of the insertion loss between antenna and receiver or between antenna and transmitter. The real insertion loss to the antenna from your transmitter or to the antenna from your receiver, I think it won't change by more than a tenth of a dB when you move that notch. But the notch is very sensitive to impedance, and so minor tweaking, as long as you don't overdo it, I think it's a valid thing to do. I've talked to people who have done it carefully, successfully, and a six-cavity duplexing filter, when all the connectors are tight and all the cables are good and so on, let me drop it. A full-size six-cavity filter that's not made by super compact techniques, I think is capable of more than 100 dB of isolation when really peak-tuned. You and I discussed last week, is 100 dB of isolation worth seeking? Absolutely. Even if you've only seen a amount of desensitization of 1 or 2 or 3 tenths of a dB, that represents 1, 2, or 3 tenths of a dB of limiting somewhere in your receiving system. That's going to take all of those frequencies that are present at your rich site on top of that building and mix them all together in every possible combination. That little bit of limiting somewhere in your receiver, maybe it's the first RF amplifier, is going to create second harmonic, third harmonic, fourth harmonic of all the frequencies going into it. Therefore, you're going to get 2x1 responses, 3x1 responses, 2x3 responses, 2x3, 3x2, and so on. In other words, twice RF times three times the LO, and so on. All of those possible combinations. Your RF amplifier stage will generate those. The laws of physics are such that some of those frequencies are going to fall on 146.25, so to speak, and you're going to have a phony signal on the input of your receiver, of your repeater, created by your own RF amplifier because it's got some amount of limiting. In the ideal world, you'd like to have an amount of descent that is almost unmeasurable. If not, you better make sure you get the world's best filters and best shielding so that no other extraneous signal can get into your system. KE2EJ, K2RIW, and TechNet.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I was just looking for Joe's experience, but I seem to remember that this was at UHF what he was doing, if I'm wrong, and that it was not, you know, a six huge can cavity. It was one of these smaller, I think intended for mobile use. But let Joe tell us what his experience was. That's just my curiosity.
Yeah, I'd like to hear this also, Joe. So, on the bench, you aligned it for the isolation that you thought was proper. Then you put it into the real installed world. You saw something quite different. What did you do next, and how successful do you believe it was? To V2RYY, K2RIW, and TechNet.
A lot of these small duplexing filters actually have a little capacitor that moves the notch. I don't expect it to be something that's step-tuned.
Let me speak. I want to make one comment before I explain what I did. I've had somebody who works in commercial service tell me that you could take a duplexer like a PD-526, and they're quite common in commercial service as well as amateur, and after you tune the thing up on a spectrum analyzer or some sort of tracking generator and get everything set up correctly, he said he always takes the last cavity or the second to last cavities on the transmitter side and peaks them. Optimizes them. Optimization, maybe he gets a tenth, a two-tenths, three more tenths a watt or something like that, differential, which is absolutely nonsensical as far as difference what you're going to make. What you do accomplish with a pass-notch duplexer is you move the notches tremendously just by moving the pass cavity adjustment, just a tiny skosh either way. It moves the notch tremendously back and forth. You lose your notch step right away. What I was playing with a notch-only duplexer, mobile duplexer, Motorola. Has a Motorola name, but it's actually a cell web duplexer, the TDE7610A. All right? You reset? I tuned the duplexer, Eric, with the IFR 1500. I had two 6dB pads in series with my cables going to the connectors of the duplexer itself. And I took that level, I subtracted that from my measurements, and knowing what I was putting into the thing with the tracking generator, I could see what the result was when I was, when it was notched properly. The difference of the duplexer itself was starting to approach 90 dB. I got a nice dip very narrowly, and I got two dips at the two frequencies of interest at about 90 dB. Okay, so that, and it, did each one very carefully, took my time doing it, locked up the nuts on the tuning screws so nice and tight, and it wouldn't move whatsoever. Then I put the thing into the mobile cabinet, which is basically a pair of mobile radios. I think they're like running M1225 radios, one transmitter, one receiver. Got that so far?
So this is UHF, right?
Yes, this is UHF. Okay, now I'll continue. So what I did was, after the duplex was tuned, for me, if I tried to take something apart, make a measurement, I'd just be upsetting the system. So I took each radio and programmed an alternate frequency in the thing, another channel. On the transmitter, I programmed the receive frequency. On the receiver, I programmed the transmit frequency as a receive frequency. So I did the receiver side first. And putting a signal on the correct receive frequency going through the duplexer, I'm measuring like not even a dB of loss on each port from what the receiver by itself is supposed to be. So that told me that I had good connectivity from the duplexer going through it on the correct frequency, and it was an attenuated signal. If I went to the alternate frequency, like the transfer frequency, and changed the channels on that receive radio, now I'm effectively measuring the notch depth of what is truly being presented to radio at 5 megs away. It was not 90 dB. In one case, on one side, it's about 70, minus 75 dB differential, and on the transmit side, it's something like about minus 80, 81, 82. But it wasn't 90. So then what I did, each side one at a time, I tweaked the little screws, going for a weaker and weaker signal. I had to increase my generator higher and higher until I approached about almost a 90 dB differential between what the generator dialed. As I tweaked the screws a little bit, I could hear I actually making the signal diminish. You're tuning actually for a dip in the signal, not a peak. And as it, I would bring the generator up until I had about a 90 dB differential on both sides, again, of what I originally saw when the duplex was on a tracking generator part of the IFR 1500. When I did that, I improved the desense characteristics by about 5 or 6 dB, because before I touched it, I had about maybe an 8 dB of desense. I was testing with the repeater keyed on, keyed off, transmitter off, because I could turn the controller on, the RIC controller, and I could listen to the receiver speaker, and I could hear the actual descent. That's where I use the RF tapper. I'm putting a certain level signal in to overcome the loss of the tap on the receive frequency, and running the that line into a 50 ohm mic quarter kilowatt load, and just using IFR 1500 as a signal source, putting it into the tap. So I initially saw about an 8 dB of descent, so I had to raise the generator by the 8 dB to bring the signal level back for when the transmitter's on compared to when I had it off. When I retrigged the screws, I brought that descent down about maybe 2 or 3 dB of descent. And with a notch-only duplexer, I think that's probably the best I can expect to get away with. If it was pass notch, they would perform much better than that, but not from a notch duplexer only. So everything has its limitations.
Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to Eric in a second. 8 dB of descent, in my mind, is a huge amount of descent. That's a lot of limiting somewhere in that system. And even bringing it down to 3 dB is good, but to get any better than that would be worth trying. And I've got another comment I'll make after Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I find that interesting.
Although I'd be curious to know what you, if you put that back on a 50-ohm system and see where things move. That would be interesting to know. But the real interesting thing here is if, you know, I don't think you have a VNA. I'd like to know what the input impedance to the radios are. And so that way you know how much things move with the difference in loaders. And you can calculate what the reactance is that's being presented. So, over to your K2 Jack.
Yeah, you and I are thinking somewhat similar on this one, Eric. To tune the receiver to the transmit frequency and vice versa in order to measure the isolation installed is a pretty good test, but not perfect. Because the real receiver on its real input frequency has a certain input impedance. In the case of a UHF repeater, you tune that receiver 5 megacycles away. That input impedance to that receiver now is some other number. So when you're doing the touch-up of the duplex and filter, you're doing it for a slightly different receiver impedance, and probably something similar is going on with the transmitter. An awful lot of receivers, when you measure the S11, reflection coefficient, input standing wave ratio, call what you like, real input impedance of a receiver, there are very few receivers that are a 50-ohm resistive load. In fact, particularly with gas-fed low-noise amplifiers, the lowest noise figure you can get out of an amplifier is not impedance matched. There's a very specific amount of impedance mismatch at the input end of a gas FET where it gives you the lowest possible standing wave ratio. That gas FET might have a 1.8 to 1 standing wave ratio on its input when you tune it for the best possible noise figure. That's one of the crazy characteristics of gas FET. So because changing impedance that the duplexing filter sees will move the notches of the best isolation. Between a rock and a hard place of measuring installed performance without disturbing the installed performance with your measurement procedure. It's a real tough nut to crack. W2RYY has been attempting to do that. W2RYY, K2RYW, go ahead, Joe.
Now, Oxidex commercial receivers have some form of input filter or bandpass filter. Even some of them have resonate.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Agreed. Even with that filter in front of the gas FET, when you set the impedance that the gas FET sees, where it gives you the lowest possible noise figure, that might be a 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio at a very specific phase angle. There's a very specific dot on the Smith chart, far away from the center of the Smith chart, where the gas FET receiver low noise amplifier gives you the best possible noise figure. If your bandpass filter has reasonably low insertion loss, it's also going to give you approximately that input standing wave ratio. You'd like to believe you can create a crazy impedance to the gas FET and yet make exactly a 50-ohm resistor on the input of the bandpass filter. There's a little bit of conflict of interest there.
It's going to be capacitive.
You know,
say something for a moment.
Okay, you're going to say something in a moment. No matter how you do it, you're still going to be getting some input standing wave ratio of that receiver system. Person who wants to say something, please give us your call letters and your name. Go right ahead.
WH4YY. These radios are meant to work across the whole band of frequencies. They're rated for at least 450 to 470. In fact, I'm using a little lower than that because this thing is operated a little below 450. It's tuned for the amateur band. But the radios operate fine. They have what's called track tuning in them. They're not the old kind of radios you're thinking of that had a helical preselector in front of them. They haven't made those kind of radios in a long time. All the stuff nowadays is all track tuning. However, it's the front-end design. And the track tuning is optimized with software as you tune the radio, as you align it in the service settings, you're adjusting the varactive voltage as you go across the entire band, you're doing it in segments. It'll give you a certain frequency, you adjust the slider and the software back and forth to adjust the varactive voltage at that frequency. So when you get done, you effectively get the same sensitivity of the radio from, say, theoretically 450 to 470. That's what kind of receiver front ends of these things have. So they're very broadband in operation. And I think getting a 3 dB of descents with a notch-only duplexer is probably a lot better than I could probably hope for, because these things don't have that kind of brick wall filtering having a real old GE receiver, the Motorola stuff, where you're running a helical front end filter before you hit your mixer, and anything plus or minus a meg away, it's just going to get dropped down tremendously. These mobile radios are not like that.
But aren't they reactor tuned at the front end?
Yes. These are M1225 radios. They have reactor tuning. They've been doing that kind of stuff for about the past 20-something years, maybe more.
Now that in itself, you look at the way those things turn on a Smith chart, you see that they move towards the lower part of the chart. That's been my experience. No, I know what you're talking about. I always said, a helical in terms of like, that was the last thing I said, because that's a really old way of doing things. But no, I understand what you're saying.
Okay, so it's broadbanded from, and the design is broadbanded from 450 to 470, so to speak. And it's got track tuning. As you choose a frequency in there, it adjusts its reactor diode, variable capacitance diode, in those filter stages so that it tracks the frequency you're now working at. That's the good news. Put a real, well-calibrated vector network analyzer on the front of that receiver. You're not going to see a 50-ohm load. I think you're going to see a 1.3, 1.4 standing wave ratio on many of those frequencies, which is good. It only gives you an apparent insertion loss of 0.1 or 0.05 dB. The standing wave ratio, you have to have a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, which is huge, before you lose half a dB of sensitivity. Tuning that filter on that front end, the tracking, not so much because of insertion loss, you're really doing it in order to give a good match to the duplexing filter. I think that's the highest priority. Impedance matching of the duplexing filter, and where does the notch move to? Until you get a huge standing wave ratio, like 2-to-1, you don't lose very much sensitivity. So there's a huge conflict of interest here. Very few people put a vector network analyzer on the front end of the receiver. Let me drop. When they do, they usually end up a little bit unhappy for two reasons. Number one, many vector network analyzers inject a signal of around 0 dBm, which overloads the living daylight out of the receiver they're trying to measure. Therefore, they get a phony reading. In many cases, you have to go to menu number 3, three menus down on the operating procedure for the vector network analyzer to force it to inject a signal of minus 20 or minus 30 dBm so you can get a reasonable receiver input impedance measurement. You overload that front end of the receiver by putting in a strong signal, you'll measure some other impedance. So, and as I said, very few people do that. And when they do, they almost always end up unhappy. They think, why is the input impedance of the receiver so bad? To be to RYY for any other comments. K2RIW and TechNet.
I don't have a VNA handy. Years and years ago, I worked for one company. I did have something like that handy, but not anymore. The only thing I could possibly do, and I still do have this device, is the way it's set right now, I could probably look at the cable feeding the duplexer and look back into it with an antenna bridge and just look at the antenna, the return loss that the front end presents across the entire frequency band and see where it's good or where it's not that good. But at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter because I optimized the duplexer to match whatever the impedance of both devices were looking backwards into them, and it did seem to make the performance better than it was as it was tuned off the service monitor directly by itself. So I did accomplish what I was trying to accomplish. It made the thing work better, and I could also stick my hands between the cables, and it didn't have anything change dramatically like I had before, where the apparent descents changed tremendously, or the notching apparently changed tremendously. I put my hand behind the duplexer between the cables. That didn't happen when I got a new set of cables put on the thing. Back to you.
I have quite often seen that effect when you move your body or your hands around the jumper cables that are between the cavities of a duplexing filter, and you watch the sense and sensitivity. You watch all kinds. You watch the descents change. You know you've got leaky cables, leaky connectors, leaky something, and your body is acting as a variable impedance, variable phase reflector as you move your hand around. That's a strong sign that something should be changed when you see that. Now, you do, Joe, have the ability to measure the input impedance of your receiver. You own some directional couplers. by way of using your directional coupler, set in the direction where it looks at reflected power from the receiver. You set the directional coupler directly in front of the receiver, straight through port to do that. And you first put a good dummy load, a known good dummy load on that directional coupler. And assuming it's got reasonable directivity, let's say minus 25 dB, now you substitute the real receiver for the dummy load, and you measure the reflected power from the receiver. If it's again minus 25 or so, you're in great shape. If it suddenly jumps to minus 10, then most likely you've got a significant reflection. Minus 10, by the way, would be close to a 2 to 1 Fanning wave ratio. So by way of a directional coupler, you can measure the real amount of reflected power from the receiver. You're doing a vector network analyzer. You're doing a scalar network analyzer measurement. Because you're not measuring phase angle with the directional coupler. You're just measuring magnitude. That's the main thing you care about. If the magnitude of reflected signal is low, then you've got a good match. Where life gets a little bit complicated is that if your directional coupler has medium poor directivity, 15 dB, can you now resolve 15 dB of reflection from the receiver when the receiver reflection and the undesired reflection inside of the coupler can now beat against each other and make the numbers bigger or smaller? There's ways you can calibrate that, but it gets a little bit sticky. Hopefully you've got a directional coupler with good directivity, and therefore you can do a poor man's scalar network analyzer measurement at the input of that receiver at every frequency you care about. So, W2LYY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Wouldn't I accomplish the same thing by using an antenna bridge that I normally measure the returnables of an antenna circuit or some other device if I look back at into the receiver itself or the transmitter when it's, of course, not transmitting, so I don't want to damage my equipment? But wouldn't I accomplish the same thing by using an antenna bridge? I'd be able to show the best point or the deepest point or the deepest dip was closer to 50 ohms. And I know it's going to be, it's going to change. See, the whole problem with this, working on this repeater, this GR500, is you can't do anything once it's all assembled. You have to take the entire assembly out with the two radios, the housed. They're in like a frame, and the frame bolts into the bottom of the duplexer. You can't even get your hands really behind the radios very easily to even tighten up the connectors to the cable. So you have to do that before you put this whole frame, radio frame, I would call it, inside the bigger box. Because you can't physically get any kind of tools behind there to put your hand in. The only thing I have behind there is the connector to the outside of the cabinet and a fan or something that blows air on the thing all the time. So to do what you kind of, you'd like to do, I'm curious. I mean, I still have this device handy, the whole repeater. I could take the whole frame out and use my antenna bridge on each particular radio and actually look up the impedance. Not the impedance, but the return loss across the whole band to see what it is. And I could even try changing frequency to see if it makes the return loss change.
On the antenna bridge, it probably picked out too much signal.
I can adjust that with the level of the generator. I don't have to put, I can put as low as 30 or something like that from the generator. As long as I can get a trace on the top, I get something as a reference.
Oh, that is already.
When it comes to measuring input impedance of a receiver, there's a zillion ways you can do it. Scalar network analyzer, vector network analyzer, directional coupler, quadrature hybrid, Wilkinson hybrid, Wheatstone bridge, antenna bridge, any of these devices that are properly calibrated can measure reflection coefficient and or impedance. And once you know the impedance of the receiver, you know how much is disturbing, capable of disturbing your duplexing filter, and therefore you can decide, are you going to do something to retweak the receiver or learn to live with it, so to speak. So there's a zillion ways you can measure input impedance of a receiver. You just have to make sure, as you already know, Joe, that you don't put in so strong a signal that you're saturating the front end and changing the impedance you're measuring. You've got the tools there, Joe. W2LYY, K2IW.
Let's just acknowledge that he accomplished his task, and we're just wanting to know what the reason is. That's all.
You're right. At the end of the day, I made the thing work better, which was the object of the game from what I originally started with. I mean, originally the thing had 18 to 20 dB of I think it was worse than 20 dB of descent. So the two cables that came with this whole setup from the factory, I don't even know how the thing worked. It didn't have a duplexer built into it. It must have had an external duplexer because it had two connectors on the back of this thing. The two connectors were UHF mini male on one side and male on the other side. The cables are made up of RG58, which is garbage cable. I don't know how the thing could ever work to begin with. So I replaced the cables with something much more substantial in quality, and it made a big difference. So that's that. Whether I want to really determine the best return loss is the receptor planet looking into it, I don't know. I could do that just out of curiosity. Maybe I'll present that to you next week and actually see if changing frequencies would change the track tuning, if that will change the apparent return loss looking backwards into the radio device itself. I'll try that. Now, if I find something interesting, I'll bring up to you next week on the TechNet.
Okay, we're looking forward to that. Good stuff. Because properly tuning an antenna to a duplexing filter to give you the full installed performance, that is an art form. You don't just simply set up a signal generator and zip through and measure 100 dB of isolation. You'd like to get 100 dB of isolation. That's beyond the dynamic range of most vector network analyzers, most spectrum analyzers, most service monitors. You're looking for 100 dB of isolation. You have to use all kinds of fancy tricks to resolve the 100 dB. It doesn't just come jumping off the front of that screen, if you know what I mean. So properly tuning these things, it's a pain in the neck to do it. It's not easy. But the difference it makes in intermod performance and receiver performance of the repeater, it is worth going through the effort. And then you got to hope that your duplexing filter is high enough in quality, mounted in a good environment where it's kept warm and dry, so that's going to keep that performance once you set it. Worth seeking. And it really separates the men from the boys. So look for 100 dB of isolation. That's a 10 billion to 1 power ratio. Hard to believe that modern instrumentation can give that to you. And there are cases, let me drop this. There are cases where a full-sized three-cavity filter on 2 meters, for instance, can give you as much as 110, maybe even 115 dB of isolation. It has been achieved on occasion. I didn't say it's easy. I didn't say every brand can do it. But if your particular brand is capable, there's some desirable performance out of the repeater that makes it worthwhile to seek. Okay, somebody is fairly sure that we've dwelled too long on this subject. What subject should we be talking about instead? Anybody else got any questions for the TechNet? K2RIW listening. Okay. Then, a little bit usual, earlier than usual, we're going to go over to the space report. WS2N. What has NASA been doing this week, Paul? WS2N, the space report number 262. K2RIW on TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick.
WS2N.
Yeah, it's early, but what are you going to do?
I sent you a couple of emails, Dick. One regarding one of the topics that we talked about.
Yeah.
Why is jet that NASA is trying to develop going to have a quiet sonic boom? I don't know if you saw that. And more like the engine is above the wing. You know, it's in development. Looks like Lockheed is going to actually try to build something, or Boeing, one of the two will eventually try to develop something from what NASA comes up with. And then the other email was 3 pictures of the refrigeration system on the James Webb Space Telescope. 2 pictures turned out to be a duplicate, but you get the idea of what it looks like. I wonder if you looked at them before I go on. Back to you, Dick.
Yes, I did, Paul. Good information. In the case of quieting the sonic boom on supersonic aircraft, some of that experiment is taking place over Florida, where they're using receiving devices on glider airplanes at various altitudes, because some of the sonic boom, they think, is a function of the various layers of the air, you know, a cold layer of air halfway between the aircraft and the ground can make a very big difference of the sonic boom. So some of the sonic boom is local weather related. Also, I'm going to make a guess that when they put the engine on top of the wing, they're using the wing as a partial shield to that shock wave that can spread down to the ground, because the engine itself is one of the very big shock wave creator. But if they think they're going to get a 2-to-1 improvement in noise power of a supersonic thud, let me drop this. I think they can achieve that. But if this is the best of all worlds, they'd like to cut it down by 10-to-1. I don't think that's achievable, because you're really banging that air with an aircraft. Unless you make the aircraft the shape of a knitting needle, it's going to create one hell of a shockwave. And a knitting needle-shaped aircraft doesn't have very much wing area and very much throat area to those engines, if you know what I mean. So you got a conflict of interest of making an efficient engine that can give you a lot of thrust and yet not make a shockwave. And how much of the shockwave is coming from the tail end? The nose of the aircraft is a big faction, a big function of the shockwave. When I listen to a whole lot of supersonic aircraft flying near Edwards Air Force Base, on the years that I was spending some time at Edwards, boy, I heard an awful lot of those shockwaves. And as the aircraft is a long distance away from them, you don't hear a bang, you hear a ba-doom, you hear a double, the end wave. I am guessing the leading edge of the aircraft makes a part of the shockwave. I'm guessing the trailing edge of the aircraft makes the other half of the shockwave. The leading edge gives you a positive pressure, the trailing edge gives you a negative pressure. And the positive pressure, I think, travels through the air faster, therefore you hear it sooner, and that's why you hear a significant delay, the ba-doom. It's like half a second between the two. In reality, at the speed that airplane is flying, the leading edge versus the trailing edge passes one fixed point in some number of milliseconds, not half a second. So, okay, and let me drop it. Now, when it comes to the cooling system, I went and found a number of websites that give you tremendous amounts of information intended for the technically oriented people on the James Webb Space Telescope. And I tried finding ones that will give me more information about the cooling system. And it's well hidden somewhere. You have to plow through an awful lot of stuff. They're really looking forward to a lot of performance out of James Webb, putting an awful lot of effort into it. One spacecraft, it better work, because there's no way to go up there and repair it. There isn't enough money to build another one. There's a zillion things that have to work just right for this thing to unfold itself. It's a real erector set that folds itself up real small in order to get into that spacecraft that launches it. And all of those squibs and everything else have to work just right in order for the thing to unfold itself and tune itself. There's a zillion things that can go wrong, so guarantee lots of people are going to keep their fingers crossed when that thing is launched, which I think is around September or October of 2018. So about 14 months from now, we're going to be launching that one, Paul. But if they get half the performance out of it they think they're going to get, wow. And I still haven't found the main... Let me drop this. One of the main things I'd like to know is fallback. If a refrigeration system has a mechanical failure, and now you're down to nothing but the cooling you get from the five layers of thermal shielding, will that still be reasonable operation of the near-infrared and far-infrared camera? I think the answer is yes. You're going to get degraded performance, but I still think it's worthwhile performance, because that's an awful big reflector on that telescope. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
They have four different detectors, so, for different wavelengths. And, last week I had the list of the nano meters that they were listed in. Make a long story short, the longer they are, the colder detectors have to be. So, out of the four detectors, three of them, the frequencies are high enough where you don't need a refrigeration system. Just the Mylar blankets that are
set downwind of the sun and the earth, so they don't pick up the infrared at all. Those three cameras would work fine, and there'll be no problem. They'll operate at whatever Kelvin I think it was. I think it'd be below 32 Kelvin for those three. But the last one, that the frequency is higher, the wavelength is longer, we drop it. That camera really needs this refrigeration system. So the good news is if it doesn't work, the refrigeration system fails, three of the cameras will do just fine. You'll just lose the last one. And, well, it's an important one. But even after years of operation, 5, 10 years go by, and something fails, something mechanical, or the refrigeration system quits, that one tactic system will be out, but the other three will still be working. That's what I heard on that. Also, the date on when this thing is launched, originally it was in September of next year. Recently, I heard it was being pushed to October. Drop. But because of a conflict with Colombo mission, that's the European Space Agency mission, which NASA's part of anyway, but they're going to launch that to Mercury. Only have a certain window to be able to do that, both to roughly the same time frame as James Webb. So there's a possible conflict with the launch schedule. The development of Colombo has been problematic over the last couple of years. So there's a possibility that might be delayed anyway. But if not, they have a preference time launch because of their window. James Webb doesn't need that window. They can go at another time. So they're talking about maybe spring of 2019. Deck, back to you.
Now, run that by again. I heard the word James Webb and 2019. Are you saying the 2018 might slip? The October of 2018 might slip to the beginning of 2019? Is that what you're saying, Paul? Go ahead.
Yes, it's a conflict time with another spacecraft that's going to be launched. Yeah, that'd be Colombo mission. That's the one that's going to Mercury. Also on a Ariane 5 rocket, but they need to launch that one right around the same time frame, and there's only so much time that they need. They need a lot of time to prepare for James Webb and to prepare for this other one that's going to go to Mercury. Won't be able to launch it with it.
Back to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.